First of all, welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, thank you. Great to be back.
I'm speaking with Mike Stone, editor of the Virology website. Very clever name. People love that name.
Thanks. Catchy, I guess.
Yeah, it's catchy, and it's a perfect pun. So you are directly involved in, I'm kind of the embedded journalist in the virus challenge that is an outgrowth of the monkeypox summit that we held with the Baileys and Tom Cowan, Andy Kaufman, yourself, Kevin Corbett. Who else was on there? Amanda Vollmer was on there. She's not involved in this project. But a bunch of us have kind of gone on to the next generation and have created the virology challenge. And I'm right in the room as this is happening. But there are some things about it I'm not sure I understand. And I would ask if you could just help me understand what exactly the challenge to these laboratories is.
Oh, sure. Well, I think for me, my understanding is it's essentially we're performing the proper controls. You know, the things that the virologist should be doing when they are culturing and acquiring their viruses. They're doing so with just material from patients that they believe have a certain set of symptoms, but they're not, testing to see whether they can find these same viral particles in, healthy people or people that, aren't SARS-CoV-2 but might have influenza. We have, people that have other diseases like lung cancer or something like that. You know, you want to check for all possible variables or other factors to make sure that the results that these virologists are finding when they do their cell culture experiments or their, genomic sequencing are not just artifacts from the process and the methods that they're using.
Yep.
And that, they can find or make sure that these methods can actually, produce and replicate these results in the samples that they're supposed to and not in the ones that they're not supposed to.
Right. So, as I understand the challenge, there are supposed to be samples from of diversity of different diagnoses. One might be SARS-CoV-2, one might be lung cancer. And then it is the role of the lab to find it, and we're going to see if multiple labs can find the same thing in these split samples that say, for example, five samples taken from a lung cancer patient sent to five different labs. Can they construct lung cancer out of that? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I think it's more along the lines of the labs will be blinded. So they won't know, they'll be sent five samples from healthy patients, five samples from lung cancer patients, five from people that have been determined to have influenza A, and then five from people who have SARS-CoV-2. So they will have, in total, 20 samples. They'll have no idea what any of these samples contain, which one's which. They'll be blinded to that. And then through their own methods, essentially they'll have to, knowing that, they're looking for SARS-CoV-2, they'll have to culture them all the same way. They'll have to, most likely, one of the reasons I recommended using influenza A is because it supposedly can be cultured using Vero cells, which is what they use for SARS-CoV-2. So even, the samples that are considered healthy and lung cancer, they'll have to all be cultured the same way. And these virologists will have to see through these cultures, treating them all exactly the same, if they will have, the cytopathogenic effect, that breakdown of the cell that they look for to determine whether a virus is present. And so if they, if they were to see those in the healthy cells or the lung cancer cells, that would immediately tell you that it's the method, the culture process that is creating the cytopathogenic effect, which most of us believe, and not an actual virus that no one can see. After that process, if they determine, whichever samples they see have this cytopathogenic effect, they would have to then put it through, electron microscopy imaging to see what the particles are. They'll have to do their own purification methods too. If they put the sample through purification, we're requiring them to put it through a purification process. They have to show that these samples contain purified and isolated particles within these electron microscopy images, and so they should only, in theory, find the SARS-CoV-2 particles in the samples with SARS-CoV-2. They should only find the influenza A samples in the influenza A sample, or the virus in those samples, and nothing in the lung cancer or the healthy individual. So in theory, that's what we're looking for, that they should be able to find the particles in the samples that they're claiming have that virus, and that they should only see the cytopathogenic effect in the ones that are supposed to have it, and not the other way around.
And then, because these same samples are going to be sent to multiple labs, this is to verify that the different labs are going to get the same result.
Exactly. Yep. That they can reproduce and replicate these results. So that they should, every lab in theory should be able to determine if these methods are valid. They should be able to determine which ones are the healthy, the five healthy samples, which ones are the five lung cancer, which ones have the COVID, and which one have influenza. I honestly don't believe they could do that.
No.
But this is why they don't do this. But it will show that it is the methods that create the effect that they're looking for, not a virus. That's the purpose.
Yeah, right. So people do think that the for example, speaking of a virus, that it's easy, or let's say well understood, that it works like a dandelion, which everyone understands how a dandelion works. It grows on your lawn. It makes a flower. The flower goes to seed. And everyone in the entire world understands that the dandelion seeds make new dandelions. People think that this is what virology understands. It doesn't. Are you following my metaphor?
Yeah. No, I actually, I was visualizing it in my head. I was thinking of someone, picking up the dandelion and blowing it, and the particles just flying everywhere.
Yeah, you know what the particles are. You know where they land. Some of them are going to become dandelions that make more dandelions.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's what we want them to show, if they can find, if these particles, I believe Dr. Mark Bailey outlined it in his in the challenge, that what many of us are saying is that these particles are most likely cellular debris, the death of the cells, the breakdown as they're put through this toxic cell culturing process. So if they are not just cellular debris and they are viruses, then they would have to have these particles and prove not only that they can find them in these samples, but then also eventually show that these particles can cause illness, in a natural way in a susceptible host. So whether it's an animal or preferably a human, in a natural way. So not through, injection, because no one's going around getting COVID from being injected. Well, I guess
sharing needles.
I could be.
Sharing needles with other COVID needles. Patients.
Yeah. So it would be in an aerosolized form, a natural way. And then, so if you can reproduce those symptoms of disease, then you would want to find that same particle, the same virus within that person or animal that was exposed to the other, to the original purified isolated version. So it's definitely a play on Koch's postulates, trying to keep virology to the methods that they outline, but it's also, sticking to the scientific method. which requires having a valid independent variable and determining cause and effect. So it's going to be interesting. I would love it if five different labs decided to go through this. I don't think they will. I would love it if they did, just so that we can finally put these methods to the test. But I think they will view it as they have nothing to gain and everything to lose.
Yes. And also, it's not ordinary labs that are involved in this scam. The labs that were... So I've explained this a lot of times on Planet Waves FM, but I guess it could always bear to be re-explained. What is meant when someone like Anthony Fauci says they have a virus found? People think it means that they found a dandelion, or at least a dandelion seed next to the dandelion, and they know how that happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that they can see that dandelion seed go on and create more dandelion.
It's easy. You can take the seeds. You can even find them in the soil before they sprout. You can take them from other dandelions. You can put them in greenhouses around the world, and you're only going to get one thing. You're not going to get daffodils or roses or Venus flytraps. You're going to get dandelions.
Exactly. Exactly. What people don't realize is they don't have the dandelion. So they can't even, manipulate anything. They don't have the seeds. They don't have anything to claim is the dandelion. So that thing that's supposed to physically exist, that you're supposed to use as your independent variable, in order to vary and manipulate, in order to show cause and effect, virologists do not have that. So they just have what they call their isolate, which is just, the fluids taken from a sick patient. Normally, I believe it's the bowel fluid. But they'll find it in other ways too.
Lung fluid, bronchovillage.
Yep. Yeah, I'm not even gonna try and pronounce that because I murder it all the time. But yes, exactly. So they'll look for it. They'll take that fluid from a person and call that the isolate, and then subject it to the cell culture process, which is just a combination of so many different substances. It's ridiculous to even refer to it as isolation
or culturing.
Or culturing, yeah.
Right.
Because that's assuming that you're growing something rather
yes.
than what it really is just a sped up cell death process and you're breaking it down.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. And then they take that mashup and they crumble that thing into a computer that then from all of the available RNA in that mashup. The mashup includes a little smear of something from a patient's nose, plus potentially always monkey cells, then potentially cancer cells, and then calf serum, fetal calf serum, potentially HeLa cells, that is to say immortalized cancer cells, plus all their other ingredients, and they crumble that into one broth, and then they have a computer build up what they are calling a virus, but it's built like CGI. It is a complete fabrication of artificial intelligence.
Yes, absolutely. It's just it's just a theoretical model. They're just taking all these things that they've called viral sequences that they've acquired over the last few decades. They'll claim one's a viral sequence, and then they just create this database and they say, well, if something matches close to that, then that's got to be a virus. Let's put it into another one to create another model. But I've gone back, I've looked at some of the genomes for the influenza genome. I believe it was influenza A, which was one of the first ones. And in order for these things to be accurate, they would have to have purified and isolated the virus. They have to have that thing. Because as you said, if they're sequencing directly from an unpurified mixed sample, they're going to have a whole bunch of stuff in there, whether it's, the host DNA, RNA, whether it's potentially, you know, if they can't get them all separated, they'll have bacteria in there, they'll have fungus, they'll have, and they admit this.
I mean, antibiotics, they'll have.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Their preservatives, their food.
Yep, exactly. And that's the thing. So you'll have all of these other genetic components in there. So they're just, you know, taking a mixture of these things and putting it together in a theoretical model. And then they claim, well, that's the viral sequence. So you keep doing that. You keep building up a database of sequences that you call viral. And so it's all built on a fraudulent foundation where they do not have, from the start, anything that was ever completely separated, any particles, any virus that was completely separated in order to be sequenced. They just have this mishmash of genetic materials in a soup.
Right. So the metaphor I'm using lately is the grocery store and the grapefruit metaphor. You really have to use metaphors to explain this stuff because it so defies the ability to even visualize it. But let's say you wanted to sequence a grapefruit so you could verify whether something else is a grapefruit, which is what the PCR test does. It's a matching test that says, is it or isn't it? And so let's say you wanted to test for grapefruit. You go to the grapefruit bin at the grocery store and you would slice it up into its genetic strands. And you would search for those in all other fruit. And I believe that using the PCR, you'd be just fine. It wouldn't match a peach. It wouldn't match an orange. It wouldn't, if you did it right, it wouldn't match an apple. All you'd hit were grapefruits as positives. But instead, what they're doing is they're sweeping up the floor of the grocery store, and they're taking all those sweepings and all the dust and all the other sources, and they're putting that in the computer, and they're saying, make me a grapefruit. And then out of all of that crud, it comes up with a genetic sequence that is being called a grapefruit but bears absolutely no resemblance to a grapefruit. And then they're testing other fruit for that phony exactly. sequence.
Yeah. And that's the hard thing when doing these metaphors, because even then, you know, you already know what a grapefruit is. You know what it looks like, you know, and everything. You can physically have a grapefruit present. But here, they don't even have the virus. They have an idea, a preconceived idea of what a virus is from the start, but they never actually have them. You know,
yeah,
it's just all theoretical.
So it's turtles all the way down, basically, because they can never go back to an original and say, here it is. That's why there's 1.7 million filings of SARS-CoV-2 genomes, but there is no one original to model them off of.
Yeah, exactly. And you've done an amazing job just going back through and tracing that, you know, those breadcrumbs throughout with the genome. I mean, it's just amazing what they will try to pass off. And even then with the SARS-CoV-2 genome, you can't even stop there with SARS-CoV-2. You have to go back then and look and see if SARS-CoV-1 was, you know, purified
and
isolated,
MERS.
Which obviously wasn't. Yep, and MERS, and then you have to go to the rat G, whatever, the bat coronavirus, which, you know, mysteriously disappeared. They can't even reproduce that even if they wanted to. And so you have to keep going, following the trail back and back and back. And see that not a single one of the, even, you know, 229E, OC43, none of the coronaviruses, none of the genomes came from a purified, isolated source. They're all mixtures and just cobbled together into this theoretical model of what they believe a coronavirus should be or what it should look like. I mean, yep. Even with the, you know, the images of the coronavirus, they just found something that looked like, you know, what they said a coronavirus should look like based off of an avian infectious bronchitis in chickens. So, you know, because they found a similar particle, there you go, you got your coronavirus. But that doesn't mean, I mean, there are so many other particles in there. How do they claim which one was the correct virus?
Yeah, it's so ridiculous, but it's also challenging. I mean, I had the background to do this when I came in, but I didn't know the specific technologies involved. And now I'm 2.5 years into that, and I'm watching this conversation go by with people like Mark Bailey, Tom Cowan, Stefano Scoglio, Mike Donio, yeah, people with real technical backgrounds, and Kevin Corbett. And so mm-hmm. I know enough to be able to read along and follow this, and it is... I'm learning something new every single day. Practically every time I check my email, I'm learning something. And so I can't imagine how impossible or difficult this would be to someone who is really trying to understand the essence of this scam. But I think that the grapefruit metaphor holds up pretty good. You wouldn't serve that dust on the table for breakfast. And you can't grow a new grapefruit out of it.
No, absolutely. And I think it's almost by design. They've gotten, you know, so many different technologies, indirect forms of evidence that they rely on to try and claim that this thing exists, that it's very confusing to anyone just trying to look in, and it's intimidating to try and figure this stuff out. And, you know, you're talking about... you know, I've been looking at this for a long time, and even just reading the conversations, like you were talking about that with the group with Dr. Bailey and Cowan, all that, a lot of that stuff is new to me. And so it's a challenging and daunting task just to try and sift through all of the methods and terminology and everything that they use. But like I said, I believe this is by design, because it keeps people who might want to look in, they're casually observant, confused, and intimidated, and not want to dig deeper underneath the surface. And I believe, you know, the more that they introduce these different indirect modes of evidence, it's very similar to what Harold Hillman talked about with, you know, EM, electron microscopy imaging. You put these samples through so many different processes and alterations that, but from the moment it's taken from a living organism to the point where it becomes an image, it is so far removed from reality at that point that it does not resemble at all what was taken from the living organism, if it was even in a living organism to begin with. And so it's just a big mess.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the however, if we start from the premise that this is all a lie, it's much easier to understand than it is trying to assume these people are somehow truthful or acting in good faith. And this must make sense if you look at it the right way or look at it carefully enough. They're starting from the premise of a pandemic, which means a lot of sick people with similar symptoms whose disease was all caused by a new thing. That's a pandemic by definition. So heart attacks are not a pandemic. That's not a new thing. Cancer is not a pandemic. It's not a new thing. So they asserted from the outset, we have a new disease, a new particle, a new disease, and that everyone sick has their sickness caused by this disease.
Yes.
They're nowhere near demonstrating that.
No. And what's absolutely ridiculous is there's no new or specific symptoms that define this new disease. You know, it's not you can just go off the check mark. I mean, it ranges from no symptoms of disease
COVID toes.
Yeah, COVID toes. Exactly. COVID,
that's my favorite.
I remember it was frostbite, but they're like, no, this is a symptom of
a respiratory virus.
Yes, exactly.
Can make your toes fall off.
Yeah. No, they even had, you know, COVID hair loss too and things like that.
But, I missed that chapter.
Oh yeah, no, that was one of the fun ones. So they've had, you know, COVID pink eye and everything. So you know, every single symptom of disease, even now they're talking about with kids with the new variants. Now they're saying, well, vomiting is becoming more of a common symptom, and headaches and stuff like that. I'm like, you've gone the gamut of every symptom, you know, possible, from allergies to colds to the flu to pneumonia. I mean, There's nothing new in there. They're just redefining the same set of symptoms, and they've put it under this new umbrella term label of COVID-19 and convinced people that it exists, but then somehow, you know, the other diseases like the flu magically disappeared. So it just, yeah, it's just a reshifting and rebranding, and it's sad that people haven't been able to catch on to this by now.
Yeah, and I think one of the most obvious examples of this is in their first COVID death, claimed COVID death, in the 61-year-old patient who had about 10 diseases, including cirrhosis and abdominal tumors and a wide diversity of other problems. They were determined to find a viral cause, and that becomes their first claimed death because, right, he has all these other diseases, and they're going to say, well, but this was really caused by a virus. And then this is picked up in every country where you find out that everyone who died of COVID had four or five other diseases on average.
Yeah, absolutely. I always had comorbidities.
Yeah, co implies that COVID is anything. I just call it being sick. And these are all people, for the most part, who would have died anyway or whose death was accelerated by the improper treatment in the hospital, whether it was venting, antiviral drugs, being isolated, and a diversity of other things that accelerated the deaths of patients in hospitals who were already very sick.
Oh, yeah. Well, and just the fear alone can create a massive amount of sickness in people that otherwise may not have experienced it because they... I mean, think about the propaganda that they were trying to sell us from the beginning with people dropping dead in the streets in China, you know. They always had some sort of really well-produced fear propaganda that they were selling the public, and then you blast these case counts and everything going up every day, every headline. Like anywhere I looked, there was this, you know, bold red COVID case counts jumping up. You know, it's that constant reminder, and they needed that. That's why they had the masks and the social distancing and all that. They needed to have that image in people's head to get them scared and afraid to go get tested. And then people that normally wouldn't be sick were becoming sick or being told they're sick and go to hospital or to see the doctor for things they normally never would have gone to. But I believe, like you said, the treatments themselves were some of the things that were causing, if there was any sort of spike or increase in those early months, it was because of the over invasive ventilation and the toxic drugs that these people were put on, or even with the elderly, you know, they were isolated from their family and friends. So there's so many factors, and yet they're trying to say that it was this virus that did it.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. We wouldn't tolerate it in most other fields of life. We wouldn't just say, ooh, there's a dead body, we must convict a black man.
Right.
But the virus is the black kid in the hoodie of medicine who's always presumed to be the killer. But there are rules that are supposed to prevent this. Like, you're supposed to do a tox investigation to make sure that people aren't being poisoned in some way. You're supposed to have clear evidence of community spread. That by May, it was obvious from the evidence that was not happening. You shouldn't have different death rates in different countries. You shouldn't have, you know, all of India not having a problem.
Yeah, or even Africa for a long time.
Yeah, why these places, there's no social distancing in India or Africa, and they're not wearing masks. Well, why isn't everyone dead in Africa and India?
Exactly. Well, and I think that's why the virus is so effective. It's this invisible boogeyman that people can't see, but they've already sold us on the existence of these things over the last few decades. So there's no way they were going to get by with, you know, claiming the flu could do this, like a new flu, so they had to use a new coronavirus, even though they've, you know, it's essentially the flu, the same symptoms of disease. And they've done such a good job of selling the story to people Well, at least the people that aren't willing to look into it further. To me, it's you know, at this point, it's so easy to spot all the holes and the just the illogical conclusions and stuff like that. It's hard for me to say that they did a good job because it's so ridiculous to me. But I know there are people that wholeheartedly believe in this, and it's just frustrating trying to get them to just take another look.
Yeah. Even Fauci admitted they were going to rebrand the flu. I don't know if you've heard this quote. I'm not sure how well you can hear it now, but it's only about a 30-second quote from a panel that was broadcast on C-SPAN on October 29th, 2019, where Fauci and a bunch of flu magnates are talking about how they're going to rebrand influenza to achieve greater market saturation of their new mRNA vaccine. So let's play this and maybe you can pick up part of it.
Yeah, it'd be great.
For some people, they get the flu, the real flu, not like I have a stomach flu, but the real flu, they get better. So there's sort of this perception, if it's so serious, how come people get flu each year and it isn't a catastrophe? When you're dealing with a disease like HIV, if you get HIV, it's serious. Whether you're young, whether you're middle-aged, whether you're old. If you get cancer, that's bad. Whether you're young, whether it's intermediate. Whereas with influenza, for some people, they go throughout life, it doesn't impact them at all. There isn't anybody that's afraid of influenza. You go in a focus group and you say, are you afraid of getting HIV if you're at risk? Oh, absolutely. Are you afraid of getting cancer? Absolutely. Are you afraid of the flu? Don't bother me. I mean, that's the reality of how people perceive flu. As Rick said, we're responsible for a variety of diseases making countermeasures, malaria, tuberculosis, Zika, Ebola, in the middle of Ebola right now. So you go to the DRC, where I went to a week and a half ago to visit our sites, and you ask somebody, are you worried about influenza? They'll laugh at you. What are you talking about, influenza? They don't vaccinate their people for influenza because they have enough problems with malaria and tuberculosis and now Ebola. So it is a perception, which is a misperception, that it is not a serious disease. But as Casey said, hundreds of thousands of people die of it each year. And when you get a pandemic, millions and millions of people. So we really do have a problem of how the world perceives influenza. And it's going to be very difficult to change that unless you do it from within and say, I don't care what your perception is, we're going to address the problem in a disruptive way and in an iterative way, because you do need both.
Wow.
Yeah.
That pretty much sums it up right there. They've convinced people now to be afraid of the flu. They just don't realize it. It's the same symptoms.
Yeah. And they can't attribute the flu to a virus anyway. And most of the time when people die of the flu, they were extremely weak in the first place. You can't really say that it was the flu that killed them, though people like to say that.
Yeah. Right. They'll just say it is like flu associated, like they do it with COVID too. Like, I can't remember the wording they used, but it'd be like a pneumonia that was brought about by it or all these. So it's not like it was the virus that did it, but it made people weak enough to become susceptible to these other conditions. And like, that's just ridiculous. They would have been susceptible to them no matter what. They were already sick.
Yeah. And so there's a lot being played with here, including people's anxiety about disease in particularly American, European society, depends on what country, but people are not that well. I mean, there were 4 billion prescriptions filled. That's the basic rate of prescriptions being filled, is 4 billion a year in the United States alone.
Wow.
So part of the reason why the anxiety grafted on was, and why the comorbidity arguments didn't work, saying, look, this is not really COVID killing people, not if 94% of them had an average of 4 other diseases, serious diseases. No, it's these other things that are killing them. Well, the thing is that many people themselves are walking around with 4 other diseases, and they're on 3 medications, or 2, or 1, or 10 medications. So that's a place for their anxiety to graft onto as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's what they've done a good job of, you know, segregating people based on age and race and stuff like that. So they'll say, well, this thing targets people in this age range or this ethnicity or this social economic status and stuff like that. And so it plays on people's fear. They look at themselves in relation to that, and it's a psychological operation on so many levels it's frustrating to say that it was effective, but it was, and it's hard to break people free from that fear, because we all have gone, some point through fearing some form of disease, and we all believe this in this virus lie at one point. So it's just a matter of showing them that this evidence does not exist. That's why that's why I keep doing what I'm doing. It's just to kind of keep hammering this point home.
Yeah, because they're going to be back. They're going to be back with a new virus. Now, I don't think it's going to catch on too soon, but we don't really know how they're going to structure the story. And I think there's other problems coming that are not directly, related to some kind of a new pandemic. They're trying with monkeypox to frighten people again. It's not catching on. People realize this is a joke. But
I don't know how anyone could take it seriously. It's when you look at it.
Yeah.
So they're claiming it's monkeypox, but it doesn't target the same people that monkeypox normally targets. They're trying to say that it's homosexual men, and then it's presented itself not like monkeypox. It's atypical. But the problem is,
it's atypical game monkeypox from the Canary Islands.
Yes, exactly. And we're getting to this point too that, they can claim all this based just on the molecular test and the genomic data. And that's the problem is they're shifting. I can see it. I mean, I believe it was Charles Callister, that he was a virologist, or he is a virologist, who had warned early 2000s that, they're relying now almost exclusively on these new molecular toys, that they're not even attempting the old ways of virology, which those were fraudulent to begin with anyways. But, we're moving away from that to the point where they say that they can identify these viruses just based on genomic data alone. They don't need to purify and isolate. They don't need the culture. And they're going to keep this going until we can finally show that this is a massive fraud, or fraud on a massive scale. They'll keep doing this. And they just have their latest and greatest, newest indirect evidence with the genomic data to try and fool everyone.
Yeah, and the problem, I think, is a lot largely about how people are in love with viruses. I mean, really, they're like Elvis.
Oh, yeah. I hate to say this, because I went to a store the other day, and it was like a bookstore, and they had little SARS-CoV-2 plushies.
Huh.
I was like, are you serious? We're selling SARS, this thing that people are supposed to fear, that we've had to mask up, social distance, and inject mRNA vaccines for, and someone's going to buy a COVID or a SARS-CoV-2 plushie as a keepsake.
It's the hula hoop. It's blue jeans. It's the ponytail on men in the 1960s. It's Elvis. People are in love with it, and they're in love with the concept of infectious disease. I had someone who I know from previous discussions is hip to the whole AIDS scam. This guy, Brian, I've known him for many years. And I was at some point in the last couple of months explaining what I was working on, and he says to me, "Now, you're not going to tell me that there's no such thing as infectious disease, are you? You can't expect me to believe that." Well, when was the last time we really asked the question? Have we? Have we shown that there really is infectious disease? There's scanty circumstantial evidence, like kids getting the chicken pox around the same time.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of ways to explain that.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be just the one virus, one cause, which is why I thought it would be, really interesting, because for me, one of the most powerful pieces of evidence that this whole contagion and infectiousness myth, well, is a myth, was the Rosenau experiments in 1918. And,
yep.
You know, no one's tried to do that today, because it's obviously deemed unethical, but we can torture animals. That's not unethical, but, you know, having
humans
someone in a room with a person.
Yeah,
humans volunteering and sitting next to someone and talking to them is apparently unethical. But if we were to recreate that today, you know, using COVID or the monkeypox, you know, and show that it's not transmissible, you cannot be in a room with the person and catch it in the way that they say that you can. I mean, to me, that would be very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it was shocking for me to read the Rosenau write-up in the Journal of American Medical Association from the summer of 1919,
mm-hmm.
Where they have this pandemic going on in 1919, what they're calling an influenza that's supposed to be highly infectious, and they took people with no history of the flu who were perfectly healthy, and people who were at the peak of sickness with Spanish flu and couldn't give it to one person in multiple experiments.
Yeah, on two different islands, too.
Well, and East Coast and West Coast.
Yep,
so
exactly.
You could do this hundreds of times, but they should have been able to give it to one person.
Yeah. Well, you think it's the most highly contagious.
Yeah, virulent
virus
of all time, yeah. But they couldn't give it to one person. So it's possible to say, well, something went wrong with the experiment. That doesn't really prove anything. You can throw all kinds of rhetoric at that. But why don't we confront the fact that even in this case of the most virulent virus of all time, they couldn't give it to one person. But then Fauci follows up in 08, with a major paper that showed that it was bacterial pneumonia that killed most people from Spanish flu, not the H1N1 virus. And he writes in his own paper that in any future outbreak, we must address the bacterial causes. We can't just be fixated on the virus causes. Fauci himself wrote this.
Yeah.
In this century.
It's amazing when you look back at some of these older papers that these virologists do and the things that they admit. He said some interesting things about like asymptomatic infection in the past too, like where he completely flip-flopped, like you wouldn't see asymptomatic infection or it's not a major driver of disease, but then later, yes, it's a major driver. I mean, he's flip-flopped so many times. It's like, I don't understand. I know he's just the poster child out there, but how anyone could take him seriously as an expert is beyond me. Like,
well, you
can't keep your story straight.
The appeal to authority is a big one, and then people think, well, the science is changing, like the science on masks. Like, well, Fauci, you know, he's in January, February, even early March, he's saying, no, they don't work, and besides, they're never going to protect you. They're only if you're really sick and you sneeze on someone. Maybe it'll help if you have a mask. But no, they don't really work. Then he changes his tune. This is political science. It is politics in the garb of science, dressed up in a lab coat.
Yeah. Well, and the problem too is they've got people convinced that the studies today are somehow superior to the ones in the past. Like, if it's older, like if it's beyond 20 years, well, that's too old. That data doesn't count. You know, and it's just got to be these modern studies that are just coming out at the height of this pandemic, you know, rushed out there with small sample sizes, not reproduced, not replicated. But yes, the conclusions and data coming from these studies are far superior to 40 plus years of other data showing that masks are ineffective. And I believe even I just mentioned this in an article that because I had read this at the beginning of the pandemic, CNN's Sanjay Gupta had written an article about how there was this flood of studies that were coming out during the pandemic, and this is like in June of 2020, and that they were basically just to be careful because it's all preprint. not replicated, conclusions and data that cannot be verified and backed up. And so that's what they do. They run with these conclusions and put them in the headlines and act as if they're truthful and that they're fact and that they're validated and verified when in fact they aren't. They're anything but.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's amazing.
I mean, I contend that the power and all this is really coming from the ground up, not the top down. That people are in love with these ideas. They're in love with authority. And I think most of all, in this very numb environment of the internet, the jolt of fear for people to them represented some kind of proof that it was real.
Yeah, I like your analogy of it almost being like a rock star, like Elvis, because that's what it's become to become, and it's being marketed that way. They've got a really strong marketing campaign with the, you know, the visuals, the spikes on the circle. Yeah, the spikes in the circle. I mean, it's become it's like a logo, you know, like a McDonald's logo now.
Yeah.
People see it and. You know, then that's how they get us. There's so many different aspects to the psychological warfare that it's, you know, we've been conditioned and it's cultured into our brains now, and we accept this without question. And then they repeat the mantras: the trust the experts, trust the science, and it's why I loved Dr. Cowan's book Breaking the Spell, because this is literally what it is. We're under a spell right now, and people, I think you're right. They do love it. They love being under that spell, and it's going to take a lot of work to break them free from it.
Yeah, and valuing the power of your body to take care of itself, and generally helping your body take care of itself. And you know, we're talking about a health crisis, so why don't we talk about wellness? Why don't we talk about health?
Yeah.
I think that everyone knows the environment is toxic. I think people would rather blame something on a virus than on the, you know, something like 40 dioxins that are found in breast milk, 60 different PCBs found in breast milk, DDT.
Yeah.
When you analyze breast milk, you basically get a toxic waste dump.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on the head. It's not as sexy to believe, you know, in environmental toxins or air pollution or any of these other things that could potentially be, or which most likely are, proven to cause disease. It's much easier to accept that there's this new virus on the loose. You know, the headlines and everything. People fall in line with that fairly easily because it's much easier to submit to that fear. And the other things are old news. You know. They don't believe that just because the environment toxins are getting worse. Well, no, you know, we've lived with it now. It's not going to impact us. It's not going to make things worse. But they don't really look at the evidence that has come out over the last decades showing these things increasing. And as it increases, I know it's correlation, but, you know, as the pollution levels rises, we are becoming more and more sick. And we're trying to find these answers in pharmaceuticals and the magic pills and these treatments that are doing nothing but making us even more sick. And so we're being poisoned from so many levels as well.
Yep. And the studies were all dropped. The studies on dioxin and PCBs, what are called dioxin-like compounds, were all dropped during the Bill Clinton administration. There was a major study underway. It was like a retrospective grouping of all studies. It was like a review, total review of the literature. And I acquired a copy of the thing, and it was about as high as stacking the New York City phone books and yellow pages for all of the boroughs on top of one another. The thing was probably enough to fit on a 4-foot bookshelf. And I still have a couple of the volumes of this. And this was on the toxicity of dioxin, which was showing, meaning dioxin-like compounds, that they are far worse than believed, and they're having all kinds of hormonal effects and so on and so forth. The entire thing was dropped and stuffed and disappeared. And very few people ever mention it in their articles, except for me, for example, because I remember it and I care. Then it's just one virus after the next said to cause every problem. It's a complete cover-up for the environmental situation.
Well, it is. It's a complete cover-up of the, you know, the people that are creating the disease through the toxins that they're exposing us to through the environment or even through the products that they sell us. It's much easier to blame the invisible boogeyman versus admitting, even though the evidence is out there, that they are the ones that are their products are creating the disease, you know?
Yeah.
I think you're spot on with that. And it's part of, one of my friends, Daniel Roydas, just, I haven't looked into it, but he just did a post about how, I can't remember which vitamin is, vitamin, I believe B6 was basically made of formaldehyde and all these other toxic components. So something as simple as like a vitamin that people think is, you know, healthy, something that they're going to get a boost of energy from or something, you know, they're putting into their body that's synthetically made and it's from all these toxic chemicals that these companies are creating and then basically selling back to us in various forms.
Yeah. The vitamin issue is a big issue. And, you know, a lot of these virus pushers are also vitamin pushers.
Mm. Exactly.
You know, they're in business, you know, in effect selling pills. I mean, Gary Null has you injecting the vitamins right into your veins. Crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So, Mike, thank you so much. And thanks for participating and for your information, sense of humor, and it's great to have you in the discussion. I consider you one of the best kitchen table journalists ever. You know, there's a whole crop of journalists who've just grown up, you know, doing this. You're sitting at your coffee table in the living room half the time, probably, figuring this out. Christine Massey is another one who is just absolutely natural born journalist. I'm having great fun watching her. She's not taking any shit from anyone.
No, I love it.
And
bulldog.
She really is. I think that, you know, the truth is the truth, and it doesn't take a lot of people or even a majority or even a large, you know, minority. Once the integrity field of what is real and what is not real, kind of congeals, it starts to become obvious to more people. And I think we just have to keep doing this and also keep the skepticism about all the claims of government, all the claims of industry, high up on our daily priority list. Question this shit.
Oh, 100%. It's a spot on assessment. I agree completely. We just got to keep pushing this this evidence or the lack of evidence, and eventually, you know, the more that we get this information out there, I believe we're making change. You know, sure, it's getting there. I see people waking up to this every day, you know, coming to the blog for the first time and commenting or reaching out to me in other ways and saying that their eyes are being opened. So, it's we are affecting change. When it's going to eventually create that, you know, that moment that we really need, I can't say for sure, but I believe we're on the right path.
Yeah, I think that this would have been a lot worse without a few dedicated people really interested in seeking the truth. A lot worse.
Yeah.
And
I want to thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but thank you for, you know, being one of the few honest journalists out there that are really honing in on this and looking at all the breadcrumbs and tracing them back, because that to me is just vitally important.
You know, I do my best. The chronology is a day-by-day audit of everything we can find that happened. And when you look at it in order, you really start to see what's going on. I mean, this is what I'm doing is not really special. It's just pretty conventional investigative reporting. But I'm doing it, and it takes help. A lot of people like you and Cindy Ragusa and other people have, you know, make this possible, and my readers who support my work. So once again, thank you.
You are definitely welcome.
We've got a whole program composed of interviews today, so we'll our break is more from the eminent Cat Power. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome. Talk to you soon.
Bless. Bye for now.
Love and communication, you will hear from me at this very